service, the wedding dinner, music and dancing, and now the final comic ritual. Katie Drome, a Jamieson relation, sat on the end of the bed with one of Jay's white silk stockings in her hand and threw it backwards over her head. If it hit Jay, the superstition said, then she would soon be married. She threw wildly, but Jay good-humouredly reached out and caught the stocking and placed it on his head as if it had landed there, and everyone clapped. A drunken man called Peter Mackay sat down on the bed beside Lizzie. "Virginia," he said. "Hamish Drome went to Virginia, you know, after he was cheated out of his inheritance by Robert's mother." Lizzie was startled. The family legend was that Robert's mother, Olive, had nursed a bachelor cousin while he was dying, and he had changed his will in her favour out of gratitude. Jay heard the remark. "Cheated," he said. "Olive forged that will, of course," Mackay said. "But Hamish could never prove it, so he had to accept it. Went to Virginia and was never heard of again." Jay laughed. "Ha! The saintly Olive, a forger."
"Hush," said Mackay. "Sir George will kill us all if he hears."
Lizzie was intrigued, but she had had enough of Jay's relations for one day.
"Get these people out," she hissed.
All the demands of custom had now been satisfied but one. "Right," said Jay. "If you won't go willingly..." He threw the blankets off his side of the bed and got out. As he advanced on the crowd, he lifted his nightshirt to show his knees. All the girls screamed as if terrified. It was their role to pretend that the sight of a man in his nightshirt was more than a maiden could bear, and they rushed out of the room in a mob, chased by the men. Jay shut the door and locked it. Then he moved a heavy chest of drawers across the doorway to make sure they would not be interrupted. Suddenly Lizzie's mouth was dry. This was the moment she had been looking forward to ever since the day Jay had kissed her in the hall at Jamieson Castle and asked her to marry him. Since then, their embraces, snatched in the few odd moments when they were left alone together, had become more and more passionate. From open-mouthed kissing, they had progressed to ever more intimate caresses. They had done everything two people could do in an unlocked room with a mother or two liable to come in at any moment. Now, at last, they were allowed to lock the door. Jay went around the room, snuffing out candles. As he came to the last, Lizzie said,
"Leave one burning."
He looked surprised. "Why?"
"I want to look at you."
He seemed dubious, and she added,
"Is that all right?"
"Yes, I suppose so," he said, and he climbed into bed. As he began to kiss and caress her, she wished they were both naked, but she decided not to suggest it. She would let him do it his way, this time. The familiar excitement made her limbs tingle as his hands ran all over her body. In a moment he parted her legs and got on top of her. She lifted her face to kiss him as he entered her, but he was concentrating too hard and he did not see. She felt a sudden sharp pain, and she almost cried out. Then it was gone. He moved inside her, and she moved with him. She was not sure if it was the thing to do, but it felt right. She was just starting to enjoy it when Jay stopped, gasped, thrust again, and collapsed on her, breathing hard. She frowned.
"Are you all right?" she said.
"Yes," he grunted.
"Is that all, then?" she thought,
but she did not say it. He rolled off her and lay looking at her.
"Did you like it?"
he said.
"It was a bit quick," she said. "Can we do it again in the morning?"
Wearing only her shift, Cora lay back on the fur cloak and pulled Mac down with her. When he put his tongue in her mouth, she tasted of gin. He lifted her skirt. The fine, red-blonde hair did not hide the folds of her sex. He stroked it, the way he had with Annie, and Cora gasped and said,
"Who taught you to do that, my virgin boy?"
He pulled down his breeches. Cora reached for her purse and took out a small box. Inside was a tube made of something that looked like parchment. A pink ribbon was threaded through its open end.
"What's that?"
said Mac.
"It's called a condom," she said. "What the hell is it for?"
By way of reply, she slipped it over his erect penis and tied the ribbon tightly. He said bemusedly,
"Well, I know my dick isn't very pretty, but I never thought a girl would want to cover it up."
She started to laugh.
"You ignorant peasant, it's not for decoration. It's to stop me getting pregnant."
He rolled over and entered her, and she stopped laughing. Ever since he was 14 years old, he had wondered what it would feel like. But he still felt he hardly knew, for this was neither one thing nor the other. He stopped and looked down at Cora's angelic face. She opened her eyes.
"Don't stop," she said. "After this, will I still be a virgin?" he said. "If you are, I'll be a nun," she said. "Now stop talking. You're going to need all your breath."
And he did. Chapter 18. Jay and Lizzie moved into the Chapel Street house on the day after the wedding. For the first time, they ate supper alone, with no one present but the servants. For the first time, they went upstairs hand in hand, undressed together, and got into their own bed. For the first time, they woke up together in their own house. They were naked. Lizzie had persuaded Jay to take off his nightshirt last night. Now she pressed herself against him and stroked his body, arousing him. Then she rolled on top of him. She could tell he was surprised.
"Do you mind?" she said.
He did not reply, but started to move inside her. When it was over, she said,
"I shock you, don't I?"
After a pause, he said,
"Well, yes. Why?"
"It's not normal for the woman to get on top."
"I've no idea what people think is normal. I've never been in bed with a man before."
"I should hope not.
But how do you know what's normal?"
"Never you mind." He had probably seduced a few seamstresses and shop girls who were overawed by him and let him take charge. Lizzie had no experience, but she knew what she wanted and believed in taking it. She was not going to change her ways. She was enjoying it too much. Jay was, too, even though he was shocked. She could tell by his vigorous movements and the pleased look on his face afterwards. She got up and went naked to the window. The weather was cold but sunny. The church bells were ringing muffled because it was a hanging day. One or more criminals would be executed this morning. Half the city's working people would take an unofficial day off, and many of them would flock to Tyburn, the crossroads at the northwestern corner of London where the gallows stood, to see the spectacle. It was the kind of occasion when rioting could break out, so Jay's regiment would be on alert all day. However, Jay had one more day's leave. She turned to face him and said,
"Take me to the hanging."
He looked disapproving.
"A gruesome request. Don't tell me it's no place for a lady."
He smiled. "I wouldn't dare."
"I know that rich and poor women and men go to see it."
"But why do you want to go?" That was a good question. She had mixed feelings about it. It was shameful to make entertainment of death, and she knew she would be disgusted with herself afterwards. But her curiosity was overwhelming.
"I want to know what it's like," she said. "How do the condemned people behave? Do they weep or pray or gibber with fear? And what about the spectators? What is it like to watch a human life come to an end?"
She had always been this way. The first time she saw a deer shot, when she was only 9 or 10 years old, she had watched enthralled as the keeper growled it, taking out its entrails. She had been fascinated by the multiple stomachs and had insisted on touching the flesh to see what it felt like. It was warm and slimy. The beast was 2 or 3 months pregnant, and the keeper had shown her the tiny fetus in the transparent womb. None of it had revolted her. It was too interesting. She understood perfectly why people flocked to see the spectacle. She also understood why others were revolted by the thought of watching it. But she was part of the inquisitive group. Jay said, "Perhaps we could hire a room overlooking the gallows. That's what a lot of people do." But Lizzie felt that would mute the experience.
"Oh, no, I want to be in the crowd," she protested.
"Women of our class don't do that."
"Then I'll dress as a man."
He looked doubtful.
"Jay, don't make faces at me. You were glad enough to take me down the coal mine dressed as a man."
"It's a bit different for a married woman."
"If you tell me that all adventures are over just because we are married, I shall run away to sea."
"Don't be ridiculous." She grinned at him and jumped onto the bed.
"Don't be an old curmudgeon," she bounced up and down. "Let's go to the hanging."
He could not help laughing.
"All right," he said.
"Bravo!" She performed her daily chores rapidly. She told the cook what to buy for dinner, decided which rooms the housemaids would clean, told the groom she would not be riding today, accepted an invitation for the two of them to dine with Captain Marlborough and his wife next Wednesday, postponed an appointment with a milliner, and took delivery of 12 brass-bound trunks for the voyage to Virginia. Then she put on her disguise. The street known as Tyburn Street, or Oxford Street, was thronged with people. The gallows stood at the end of the street outside Hyde Park. Houses with a view of the scaffold were crowded with wealthy spectators who had rented rooms for the day. People stood shoulder to shoulder on the stone wall of the park. Hawkers moved through the crowd selling hot sausages and tots of gin and printed copies of what they said were the dying speeches of the condemned. Mac held Cora's hand and pushed through the crowd. He had no desire to watch people getting killed, but Cora insisted on going. Mac just wanted to spend all his free time with Cora. He liked holding her hand, kissing her lips whenever he wanted to, and touching her body in odd moments. He liked just to look at her. He enjoyed her devil-may-care attitude and her rough language and the wicked look in her eye. So he went with her to the hanging. A friend of hers was going to be hanged. Her name was Dolly Macaroni, and she was a brothel keeper, but her crime was forgery. "What did she forge, anyway?" Mac said as they approached the gallows. "A bank draft. She changed the amount from £11 to £80. Where did she get a draft for £11? From Lord Massey. She says he owed her more. She ought to have been transported, not hanged. They nearly always hang forgers." They were as close as they could get, about 20 yards away. The gallows was a crude wooden structure, just 3 posts with crossbeams. 5 ropes hung from the beams, their ends tied in nooses, ready for the condemned. A chaplain stood nearby, with a handful of official-looking men who were presumably law officers. Soldiers with muskets kept the crowd at a distance. Gradually, Mac became aware of a roaring sound from farther down Tyburn Street. "What's that noise?" he asked Cora. "They're coming." First, there was a squad of peace officers on horseback, led by a personage who was presumably the city marshal. Next were the constables, on foot and armed with clubs. Then came the tumbril, a high 4-wheeled cart drawn by 2 plough horses. A company of javelin men brought up the rear, holding their pointed spears rigidly upright. In the cart, sitting on what appeared to be coffins, their hands and arms bound with ropes, were 5 people. 3 men, a boy of about 15, and a woman. "That's Dolly," Cora said, and she began to cry. Mac stared in horrid fascination at the 5 who were to die. One of the men was drunk, the other 2 looked defiant. Dolly was praying aloud, and the boy was crying. The cart was driven under the scaffold. The drunk man waved to some friends, villainous-looking types, who stood at the front of the crowd. They shouted jokes and ribald comments.
"Kind of the sheriff to invite you along," and "I hope you've learned to dance," and "Try that necklace on for size."
Dolly asked God's forgiveness in a loud, clear voice. The boy cried,
"Save me, Mama! Save me, please!"
The 2 sober men were greeted by a group at the front of the crowd. After a moment, Mac distinguished their accents as Irish. One of the condemned men shouted,
"Don't let the surgeons have me, boys!"
There was a roar of assent from his friends.
"What are they talking about?" Mac asked Cora. "He must be a murderer. The bodies of murderers belong to the company of surgeons. They cut them up to see what's inside."
Mac shuddered. The hangman climbed on the cart. One by one, he placed the nooses around their necks and drew them tight. None of them struggled or protested or tried to escape. It would have been useless, surrounded as they were by guards, but Mac thought he would have tried anyway. The priest, a bald man in stained robes, got up on the cart and spoke to each of them in turn. Just for a few moments to the drunk, 4 or 5 minutes with the other 2 men, and longer with Dolly and the boy. Mac had heard that sometimes executions went wrong, and he began to hope it would happen this time. Ropes could break. The crowd had been known to swarm the scaffold and release the prisoners. The hangman might cut people down before they were dead. It was too awful to think these 5 living human beings would in a few moments be dead. The priest finished his work. The hangman blindfolded the five people with strips of rag, then got down, leaving only the condemned on the cart. The drunk man could not keep his balance, and he stumbled and fell, and the noose began to strangle him. Dolly continued to pray loudly. The hangman whipped the horses. Lizzie heard herself scream, "No!" The cart jerked and moved off. The hangman lashed the horses again, and they struggled to a trot. The cart was drawn from under the condemned people, and one by one they fell to the extent of the ropes. First the drunk, already half dead, then the two Irishmen, then the weeping boy, and at last the woman whose prayer was cut off in mid-sentence. Lizzie stared at the five bodies dangling from the ropes, and she was filled with loathing for herself and the crowd around her. They were not all dead. The boy mercifully seemed to have broken his neck instantly, as did the two Irishmen, but the drunk was still moving, and the woman, whose blindfold had slipped, stared out of open, terrified eyes as she slowly choked. Lizzie buried her face in Jay's shoulder. She would have been glad to leave, but she forced herself to stay. She had wanted to see this, and now she should stick it out until the end. She opened her eyes again. The drunk had expired, but the woman's face worked in agony. The rowdy onlookers had fallen silent, stilled by the horror in front of them. Several minutes went by. At last, her eyes closed. The sheriff stepped up to cut the bodies down, and that was when the trouble started. The Irish group surged forward, trying to get past the guards to the scaffold. The constables fought back, and the javelin men joined in, stabbing at the Irish. Blood began to flow. "I was afraid of this," Jay said. "They want to keep their friends' bodies out of the hands of the surgeons. Let's get clear as fast as we can." Many around them had the same idea, but those at the back were trying to get closer and see what was happening. As some surged one way and some the other, fist fights broke out. Jay tried to force a way through. Lizzie stuck close to him. They found themselves up against an unbroken wave of people going the other way. Everyone was shouting or screaming. They were forced back towards the gallows. The scaffold was now swarming with Irish, some of whom were beating off the guards and dodging the lunges of the javelin men, while others tried to cut down the bodies of their friends. For no apparent reason, the crush around Lizzie and Jay eased suddenly. She turned around and saw a gap between two big, rough-looking men. "Jay, come on!" she shouted and darted between them. She turned to make sure Jay was behind her. Then the gap closed. Jay stepped forward to push his way through, but one of the men raised a hand threateningly. Jay flinched and stepped back, momentarily afraid. The hesitation was fatal. He was cut off from her. She saw his blonde head above the crowd and fought to get back to him, but she was stopped by a wall of people. "Jay!" she screamed. "Jay!" He shouted back, but the crowd forced them farther apart. He was pushed in the direction of Tyburn Street, while the crowd took her the opposite way towards the park. A moment later, he was lost from sight. End of Side 9. Side 10. She was on her own. She gritted her teeth and turned her back on the scaffold. She faced a solid pack of people. She tried to push herself between a small man and a big-bosomed matron.
"Keep your hands to yourself, young man," the woman said.
Lizzie persisted in pushing and managed to squeeze through. She repeated the process. She trod on the toes of a sour-faced man, and he punched her in the ribs. She gasped with pain and pressed on. She saw a familiar face and recognized Mac McCash. He, too, was fighting his way through the crowd.
"Mac!"
she yelled gratefully. He was with the red-haired woman who had been at his side in Grosvenor Square.
"Over here!" Lizzie cried. "Help me!"
He saw her and recognized her. Then a tall man's elbow jabbed her eye, and for a few moments she could hardly see. When her vision returned to normal, Mac and the woman had vanished. Grimly she pressed on. Inch by inch she was getting away from the fracas at the gallows. With each step she found it a little easier to move. Within 5 minutes she was no longer squeezing between tightly packed people, but passing through gaps several inches wide. Eventually she came up against the front wall of a house. She worked her way along to the corner of the building and stepped into an alley 2 or 3 feet wide. She leaned against the house wall, catching her breath. The alley was foul and stank of human waste. Her ribs ached where she had been punched. She touched her face gingerly and found that the flesh around her eye was swelling. She hoped Jay was all right. She turned around to look for him and was startled to see two men staring at her. One was middle-aged and unshaven with a fat belly, the other a youth of about 18. Something about their stares frightened her, but before she could move away they pounced. They grabbed her by the arms and threw her to the ground. They snatched her hat and the man's wig she wore, pulled off her silver-buckled shoes, and went through her pockets with bewildering speed, taking her purse, her pocket-watch, and her handkerchief. The older man shoved his spoils into a sack, stared at her for a moment, then said,
"That's a good coat. Nearly new."
They both bent over her again and began to pull off her coat and matching waistcoat. She struggled, but all she achieved was to rip her shirt. They stuffed her garments into a sack. She realized her breasts were exposed. Hastily she covered herself with the shreds of her clothes, but she was too late.
"Hey, it's a girl!"
cried the younger man. She scrambled to her feet, but he grabbed her and held her. The fat one stared at her.
"And a pretty girl, too, by God," he said.
He licked his lips.
"I'm going to fuck her," he said decisively.
Seized with horror, Lizzie struggled violently, but she could not shake off the young man's grip. The youth looked back along the alley to the crowd in the street.
"What, here?" "Nobody's looking this way, you young fool."
He stroked himself between the legs.
"Get those britches off her and let's have a look."
The boy threw her to the ground, sat on her heavily and started to pull off her britches while the other man watched. Fear flooded Lizzie and she screamed at the top of her voice, but there was so much noise in the street she doubted whether anyone would hear her. Then suddenly Mac McCash appeared. She glimpsed his face and a raised fist, then he struck the older one on the side of the head. The thief rocked sideways and staggered. Mac hit him again and the man's eyes rolled up into his head. Mac hit him a third time and the man slumped and lay still. The boy scrambled off Lizzie and tried to run away, but she grabbed his ankle and tripped him. He measured his length on the ground. Mac picked him up and threw him against the house wall, then hit him on the chin with a punch that came up from below with all his weight behind it, and the boy fell unconscious on top of his partner in crime. Lizzie got to her feet.
"Thank God you were here,"
she said fervently. Tears of relief filled her eyes. She threw her arms around him and said,
"You saved me. Thank you. Thank you."
He hugged her closely.
"You saved me once, when you pulled me out of the river."
She held him tight and tried to stop shaking. She felt his hand behind her head, stroking her hair. In her breeches and shirt, with no petticoats to get in the way, she could feel the entire length of his body pressed against hers. He felt completely different from her husband. Jay was tall and supple, Mac short, massive, and hard. He shifted and looked at her. His green eyes were mesmerizing. The rest of his face seemed to blur.
"You saved me, and I saved you," he said with a wry smile. "I'm your guardian angel, and you're mine."
She began to calm down. She remembered that her shirt was torn and her breasts were bare.
"If I were an angel, I wouldn't be in your arms," she said,
and she made to detach herself from his embrace. He looked into her eyes for a moment, then gave that wry smile again and nodded, as if agreeing with her. He turned away. He bent and took the sack from the older thief's limp hand. He took out her waistcoat and she put it on, buttoning it hastily to cover her nakedness. As soon as she felt safe again, she began to worry about Jay.
"I have to look for my husband," she said as Mac helped her put her coat on. "Will you help me?"
"Of course." He handed her the wig and hat, purse and watch and handkerchief.
"What about your red-haired friend?" she asked.
"Cora. I made sure she was safe before I came after you."
"Did you?"
Lizzie felt unreasonably irritated.
"Are you and Cora lovers?"
she said rudely. Mac smiled. "Yes," he said. "Since the day before yesterday."
"My wedding day?"
"I'm having a wonderful time. Are you?"
A sharp retort came to her lips. Then, despite herself, she laughed.
"Thank you for rescuing me," she said,
and she leaned forward and kissed him briefly on the lips.
"I'd do it all over again for a kiss like that."
She grinned at him, then turned towards the street. Jay stood there watching. She felt terribly guilty. Had he seen her kiss McCash? She guessed he had, by the thunderous look on his face.
"Oh, Jay," she said, "thank heaven you're all right."
"What happened here?"
he said. "Those two men robbed me. I knew we shouldn't have come." He took her by the arm to lead her out of the alley. "Makash knocked them down and rescued me," she said. "That's no reason to kiss him," said her husband. Chapter 19. Jay's regiment was on duty in Palace Yard on the day of John Wilkes's trial. The liberal hero had been convicted of criminal libel years ago and had fled to Paris. On his return, earlier that year, he was accused of being an outlaw. But while the legal action against him dragged on, he won the Middlesex by-election handsomely. However, he had not yet taken his seat in Parliament, and the government hoped to prevent him doing so by having him convicted in court. Jay steadied his horse and looked nervously over the crowd of several hundred Wilkes supporters milling around outside Westminster Hall, where the trial was taking place. Many of them wore, pinned to their hats, the blue cockade that identified them as Wilkesites. Tories, such as Jay's father, wanted Wilkes silenced, but everyone was worried about what his supporters would do. If violence broke out, Jay's regiment was supposed to keep order. There was a small detachment of guards, too damn small in Jay's opinion, just 40 men and a few officers under Colonel Cranborough, Jay's commanding officer. They formed a thin red-and-white line between the court building and the mob. Cranborough took orders from the Westminster magistrates, represented by Sir John Fielding. Fielding was blind, but that did not seem to hinder him in his work. He was a famous reforming justice, although Jay thought him too soft. He had been known to say that crime was caused by poverty. That was like saying adultery was caused by marriage. The young officers were always hoping to see action, and Jay said he felt the same, but he was also scared. He had never actually used his sword or gun in a real fight. It was a long day, and the captains took turns to break off from patrolling and drink a glass of wine. Towards the end of the afternoon, while Jay was giving his horse an apple, he was approached by Sidney Lennox. His heart sank. Lennox wanted his money. No doubt he had intended to ask for it when he called at Grosvenor Square, but had postponed the request because of the wedding. Jay did not have the money, but he was terrified that Lennox would go to his father. He put on a show of bravado. "What are you doing here, Lennox? I didn't know you were a Wilkesite." "John Wilkes can go to the devil," Lennox replied. "I've come about the £150 you lost at Lord Archer's faro game." Jay blanched at the reminder of the amount. His father gave him £30 a month, but it was never enough, and he did not know when he could lay his hands on £150. The thought that his father might find out he had lost more money gambling made his legs feel weak. He would do anything to avoid that. "I may have to ask you to wait a little longer," he said with a feeble attempt at an air of superior indifference. Lennox did not reply directly.
"I believe you know a man called Mac Makash."
"Unfortunately, I do."
"He started his own coal-heaving gang with the help of Caspar Gordonson. The two of them are causing a lot of trouble."
"It doesn't surprise me. He was a damn nuisance in my father's coal mine."
"The problem is not just Makash," Lennox went on. "His two cronies, Dermot Riley and Charlie Smith, have gangs of their own now, and there'll be more by the end of the week."
"That will cost you undertakers a fortune."
"It will ruin the trade unless it's stopped."
"All the same, it's not my problem."
"But you could help me with it."
"I doubt it." Jay did not want to get involved with Lennox's business.
"It would be worth money to me."
"How much?" Jay said warily.
£150.
Jay's heart leaped. The prospect of wiping out his debt was a godsend. But Lennox would not readily give away so much. He must want a heavyweight favour. "What would I have to do?" Jay said suspiciously.
"I want the shipowners to refuse to hire Makash's gangs. Now, some of the coal shippers are undertakers themselves, so they will cooperate. But most are independent. The biggest owner in London is your father. If he gave a lead, the others would follow."
"But why should he? He doesn't care about undertakers and coal heavers."
"He's alderman of Wapping, and the undertakers have a lot of votes. He ought to defend our interests. Besides, the coal heavers are a troublesome crowd, and we keep them under control."
Jay frowned. It was a tall order. He had no influence at all with his father. Few people did. Sir George could not be influenced into coming in out of the rain. But Jay had to try. A roar from the crowd signalled that Wilkes was coming out. Jay mounted his horse hastily. "I'll see what I can do," he called to Lennox as he trotted away.
Jay found Chip Marlborough and said, "What's happening?" "Wilkes has been refused bail and committed to the King's Bench prison." The colonel was mustering his officers. He said to Jay, "Pass the word. No one is to fire unless Sir John gives the order. Tell your men." Jay suppressed an anxious protest. How were soldiers to control the mob if their hands were tied? But he rode around and relayed the instruction. A carriage emerged from the gateway. The crowd gave a blood-curdling roar, and Jay felt a stab of fear. The soldiers made a path for the carriage by beating the mob with their muskets. Wilkes's supporters ran across Westminster Bridge, and Jay realized that the carriage would have to cross the river into Surrey to get to the prison. He spurred his horse towards the bridge, but Colonel Cranborough waved him down. "Don't cross the bridge," he commanded. "Our orders are to keep the peace here, outside the court." Jay reined in. Surrey was a separate district, and the Surrey magistrates had not asked for army support. This was ridiculous. He watched, helpless, as the carriage crossed the River Thames. Before it reached the Surrey side, the crowd stopped it and detached the horses. Sir John Fielding was in the heart of the throng, following the carriage with two assistants to guide him and tell him what was happening. As Jay watched, a dozen strong men got between the traces and began to pull the carriage themselves. They turned it around and headed back towards Westminster, and the mob roared its approval. Jay's heart beat faster. What would happen when the mob reached Palace Yard? Colonel Cranborough was holding up a cautionary hand, indicating that they should do nothing. Jay said to Chip, "Do you think we could take the carriage away from the mob?"
"The magistrates don't want any bloodshed," Chip said.
One of Sir John's clerks darted through the crowd and conferred with Cranborough. Once across the bridge, the mob turned the carriage east. Cranborough shouted to his men, "Follow at a distance, don't take action." The detachment of guards fell in behind the mob. Jay ground his teeth. This was humiliating. A few rounds of musket fire would disperse the crowd in a minute. He could see that Wilkes would make political capital out of being fired on by the troops, but so what? The carriage was drawn along the Strand and into the heart of the city. The mob sang and danced and shouted, "Wilkes and Liberty! And number 45!" They did not stop until they reached Spitalfields. There the carriage stopped outside the church. Wilkes got out and went into the Three Tuns Tavern, hastily followed by Sir John Fielding. Some of his supporters went in after them, but they could not all get through the door. They milled about in the street for a while, and then Wilkes appeared at an upstairs window to tumultuous applause. He began to speak. Jay was too far away to hear everything, but he caught the general drift. Wilkes was appealing for order. During the speech, Fielding's clerk came out and spoke to Colonel Cranborough again. Cranborough whispered the news to his captains. A deal had been done. Wilkes would slip out of a back door and surrender himself at the King's Bench prison tonight. Wilkes finished his speech, waved and bowed and vanished. As it became clear that he was not going to reappear, the crowd began to get bored and drift away. Sir John came out of the Three Tuns and shook Cranborough's hand.
"A splendid job, Colonel, and my thanks to your men. Bloodshed was avoided, and the law was satisfied."
He was putting a brave face on it, Jay thought, but the truth was that the law had been laughed at by the mob. As the guard marched back to Hyde Park, Jay felt depressed. He had been keyed up for a fight all day, and the letdown was hard to bear. But the government could not go on appeasing the mob forever. Sooner or later they would try to clamp down. Then there would be action. When he had dismissed his men and checked that the horses were taken care of, Jay remembered Lennox's proposition. Jay was reluctant to put Lennox's plan to his father, but it would be easier than asking for £150 to pay another gambling debt. So he decided to call in at Grosvenor Square on his way home. It was late. The family had eaten supper, the footman said, and Sir George was in the small study at the back of the house. Jay hesitated in the cold, marble-floored hall. He hated to ask his father for anything. He would either be scorned for wanting the wrong thing, or reprimanded for demanding more than his due. But he had to go through with it. He knocked on the door and went in. Sir George was drinking wine and yawning over a list of molasses prices. Jay sat down and said, "Wilkes was refused bail."
"So I heard."
Perhaps his father would like to hear how Jay's regiment had kept the peace. "The mob drew his carriage to Spitalfields and we followed, but he promised to surrender himself tonight." Good. What brings you here so late? Jay gave up trying to interest his father in what he had done today. Did you know that Malachy McCash has surfaced here in London? His father shook his head. I don't think it matters, he said dismissively. He's stirring up trouble among the coal heavers. That doesn't take much doing. They're a quarrelsome lot.
I've been asked to approach you on behalf of the undertakers.
Sir George raised his eyebrows. Why, you? He said in a tone which implied that no one with any sense would employ Jay as an ambassador. Jay shrugged. I happen to be acquainted with one particular undertaker, and he asked me to come to you. Tavern keepers are a powerful voting group, Sir George said thoughtfully. What's the proposition?
McCash and his friends have started independent gangs who don't work through the undertakers. The undertakers are asking ship owners to be loyal to them and turn away the new gangs. They feel that if you give a lead, the other shippers will follow.
I'm not sure I should interfere. It's not our battle. Jay was disappointed. He thought he had put the proposition well. He pretended indifference. It's nothing to me, but I'm surprised. You're always saying we've got to take a firm line with seditious labouring men who get ideas above their station. At that moment there was a terrific hammering at the front door. Sir George frowned, and Jay stepped into the hall to have a look. A footman hurried past and opened the door. There stood a burly working man with clogs on his feet and a blue cockade in his greasy cap.
"Light up," he ordered the footman. "Illuminate for Wilkes."
Sir George emerged from the study and stood with Jay, watching. Jay said, "They do this, make people put candles in all their windows in support of Wilkes." Sir George said, "What's that on the door?" They walked forward. The number 45 was chalked on the door. Outside in the square, a small mob was going from house to house. Sir George confronted the man on the doorstep.
"Do you know what you've done?" he said. "That number is a code. It means the king is a liar. Your precious Wilkes has gone to jail for it, and you could too." "Will you light up for Wilkes?" the man said, ignoring Sir George's speech.
Sir George reddened. It infuriated him when the lower orders failed to treat him with deference.
"Go to the devil,"
he said, and he slammed the door in the man's face. He went back to the study, and Jay followed him. As they sat down, they heard the sound of breaking glass. They both jumped up again and rushed into the dining room at the front of the house. There was a broken pane in one of the two windows and a stone on the polished wood floor.
"That's best crown glass," Sir George said furiously. "2 shillings a square foot."
As they stood staring, another stone crashed through the other window. Sir George stepped into the hall and spoke to the footman.
"Tell everyone to move to the back of the house, out of harm's way," he said.
The footman, looking scared, said,
"Wouldn't it be better just to put candles in the windows like they said, sir?"
"Shut your damned mouth and do as you're told," Sir George replied.
There was a third smash somewhere upstairs, and Jay heard his mother scream in fright. He ran up the stairs, his heart pounding, and met her coming out of the drawing room.
"Are you all right, Mama?"
She was pale but calm.
"I'm fine. What's happening?"
Sir George came up the stairs, saying with suppressed fury,
"Nothing to be afraid of, just a damned Wilkesite mob. We'll stay out of the way until they've gone."
As more windows were smashed, they all hurried into the small sitting room at the rear of the house. Jay could see his father was boiling with rage. Being forced to retreat was guaranteed to madden him. This might be the moment to bring up Lennox's request again. Throwing caution to the winds, he said,
"You know, Father, we really have to start dealing more decisively with these troublemakers." "What the devil are you talking about?"
"I was thinking of McCash and the coal heavers. If they're allowed to defy authority once, they'll do it again." It was not like him to speak this way, and he caught a curious glance from his mother. He ploughed on.
"Better to nip those things in the bud. Teach them to know their place."
Sir George looked as if he were about to make another angry rejoinder. Then he hesitated, scowled, and said,
"You're absolutely right. We'll do it tomorrow."
Jay smiled. Chapter 20. As Mac walked down the muddy lane known as Wapping High Street, he felt he knew what it must be like to be king. From every tavern doorway, from windows, from yards and rooftops, men waved at him, called out his name, and pointed him out to their friends. Everyone wanted to shake his hand. But the men's appreciation was nothing compared with that of their wives. The men were not only bringing home 3 or 4 times as much money, they were also ending the day much soberer. The women embraced him in the street and kissed his hands and called to their neighbours, saying,
"It's Mac Macash, the man who defied the undertakers. Come quick and see."
He reached the waterfront and looked over the broad grey river. The tide was high and there were several new ships at anchor. He looked for a boatman to row him out. The traditional undertakers waited at their taverns until the captains came to them and asked for a gang to uncoal their ships. Mac and his gangs went to the captains, saving them time and making sure of the work. He went out to the Prince of Denmark and climbed aboard. The crew had gone ashore, leaving one old sailor smoking a pipe on deck. He directed Mac to the captain's cabin. The skipper was at the table, writing laboriously in the ship's log with a quill pen.
"Good day to you, Captain," Mac said with a friendly smile. "I'm Mac Macash."
"What is it?" the man said gruffly. He did not ask Mac to take a seat. Mac ignored his rudeness. Captains were never very polite.
"Would you like your ship uncooled quickly and efficiently tomorrow?"
he said pleasantly.
"No."
Mac was surprised that someone got here before him.
"Who's going to do it for you, then?"
"None of your dumb business."
"It certainly is my business, but if you don't want to tell me, no matter. Someone else will."
"Good day to you, then." Mac frowned. He was reluctant to leave without finding out what was wrong.
"What the devil is the trouble with you, Captain? Have I done something to offend you?"
"I've nothing more to say to you, young man, and you'll oblige me by taking your leave." Mac had a bad feeling about this, but he could not think of anything else to say, so he left. Ship's captains were a notoriously bad-tempered lot, perhaps because they were away from their wives so much. He looked along the river. Another new ship, Whitehaven Jack, was anchored next to the Prince. Her crew were still furling sails and winding ropes into neat coils on the deck. Mac decided to try her next and got his boatman to take him there. He found the captain on the poop deck with a young gentleman in sword and wig. He greeted them with the relaxed courtesy which he had found was the fastest way to win people's confidence.
"Captain, sir, good day to you both."
The captain was polite.
"Good day to you. This is Mr. Tallow, the owner's son. What's your business?"
Mac replied, "Would you like your ship uncooled tomorrow by a fast and sober gang?" The captain and the gentleman spoke together.
"Yes," said the captain.
"No," said Tallow. The captain showed surprise and looked questioningly at Tallow. The young man addressed Mac, saying,
"You're Macash, aren't you?"
"Yes, I believe shippers are beginning to take my name as a guarantee of good work."
"We don't want you," said Tallow.
The second rejection riled Mac.
"Why not?"
he said challengingly.
"We've done business with Harry Nipper at the Frying Pan for years and never had any trouble."
The captain interjected.
"I wouldn't exactly say we've had no trouble."
Tallow glared at him.
Mac said, "And it's not fair that men should be forced to drink their wages, is it?"
Tallow looked piqued.
"I'm not going to argue with the likes of you. There's no work for you here, so be off."
Mac persisted.
"But why would you want your ship uncooled in 3 days by a drunken and rowdy gang when you could have it done faster by my men?"
The captain, who was clearly not overawed by the owner's son, added,
"Yes, I'd like to know that."
"Don't you dare to question me, either of you,"
Tallow said. He was trying to stand on his dignity, but he was a little too young to succeed. A suspicion crossed Mac's mind.
"Has someone told you not to hire my gang?"
The look on Tallow's face told him he had guessed right.
"You'll find that nobody on the river will hire your gang, or Riley's, or Charlie Smith's," Tallow said petulantly. "The word has gone out that you're a troublemaker."
Mac realized this was very serious, and a cold chill settled on his heart. He had known that Lennox and the undertakers would move against him sooner or later, but he had not expected them to be supported by the shipowners. It was a little puzzling. The old system was not particularly good for the owners. However, they had worked with the undertakers for years, and perhaps sheer conservatism led them to side with people they knew, regardless of justice. It would be no use to show anger, so he spoke mildly to Tallow.
"I'm sorry you've made that decision. It's bad for the men and bad for the owners. I hope you'll reconsider, and I bid you good day."
Tallow made no reply, and Jay had himself rowed ashore. He felt dashed. He held his head in his hands and looked at the filthy brown water of the Thames. What had made him think he could defeat a group of men as wealthy and ruthless as the Undertakers? They had connections and support. Who was he? Mark McCash from Hugh. He should have foreseen this. He jumped ashore and made his way to St. Luke's Coffee House, which had become his unofficial headquarters. There were now at least 5 gangs working the new system. Next Saturday night, when the remaining old-style gangs received their decimated wages from the rapacious tavern keepers, most of them would change over. But the shippers' boycott would ruin that prospect. The coffee house was next to St. Luke's Church. It served beer and spirits as well as coffee, and food too, but everyone sat down to eat and drink, whereas most stood up in a tavern. Cora was there, eating bread and butter. Although it was mid-afternoon, this was her breakfast. She was often up half the night. Mac asked for a plate of hashed mutton and a tankard of beer and sat down with her. Straight away, she said, "What's the matter?" He told her. As he talked, he watched her innocent face. She was ready for work, dressed in the orange gown she had worn the first time he met her and scented with her spicy perfume. She looked like a picture of the Virgin Mary, but she smelled like a sultan's harem. It was no wonder that drunks with gold in their purses were willing to follow her down dark alleys, he thought. He had spent 3 of the last 6 nights with her. She wanted to buy him a new coat. He wanted her to give up the life she led. She was his first real lover. As he was finishing his story, Dermot and Charlie came in. He had been cherishing a faint hope that they might have had better luck than he, but their expressions told him they had not. Charlie's black face was a picture of despondency, and Dermot said in his Irish brogue, "The owners have conspired against us. There's not a captain on the river that will give us work." "Damn their eyes," Max said. The boycott was working, and he was in trouble. He suffered a moment of righteous indignation. All he wanted was to work hard and earn enough money to buy his sister's freedom, but he was constantly thwarted by people who had money in bagfuls. Dermot said, "We're finished, Mac." His readiness to give up angered Mac more than the boycott itself. "Finished," he said scornfully. "Are you a man or what?" "But what can we do?" said Dermot. "If the owners won't hire our gangs, the men will go back to the old system. They've got to live." Without thinking, Mac said, "We could organize a strike." The other men were silent. Cora said, "Strike?" Mac had blurted out his suggestion as soon as it came into his mind, but as he thought more, it seemed the only thing to do. "All the coal heavers want to change to our system," he said. "We could persuade them to stop working for the old undertakers. Then the shippers would have to hire the new gangs." Dermot was skeptical. "Suppose they still refuse to hire us?" This pessimism angered Mac. Why did men always expect the worst? "If they do that, no coal will come ashore." "What would the men live on?" "They can afford to take a few days off. It happens all the time. When there are no coal ships in port, none of us work." "That's true. But we couldn't hold out forever." Mac wanted to scream with frustration.
"Nor can the shippers. London must have coal."
Dermot still looked dubious. Cora said,
"But what else can you do, Dermot?"
Dermot frowned, and he thought for a moment. Then his face cleared.
"I'd hate to go back to the old ways. I'll give it a try, by gob."
"Good," said Mac, relieved.
"I was in a strike once," Charlie said lugubriously. "It's the wives that suffer."
"When were you in a strike?"
Mac asked. He had no experience. It was something he had read about in the newspapers.
"Years ago, on Tyneside, I was a coal miner."
"I didn't know you'd been a miner."
It had never occurred to Mac, or anyone in Hugh, that miners could strike.
"How did it end?"
"The coal owners gave in," Charlie admitted.
"There you are,"
Mac said triumphantly.
Cora said anxiously, "You're not up against northern landowners here, Mac. You're talking about London tavern keepers, the scum of the earth. They might just send someone to cut your throat while you sleep."
Mac looked into her eyes and saw that she was genuinely frightened for him.
"I'll take precautions," he said.
She gave him a skeptical look, but said no more.
Dermot said, "It's the men that will have to be persuaded."
"That's right," Mac said decisively. "There's no point in the 4 of us discussing it as if we had the power to make the decision. We'll call a meeting. What o'clock is it?"
They all glanced outside. It was becoming evening. Cora said,
"It must be 6.
Mac went on,
The gangs that are working today will finish as soon as it gets dark. You two go around all the taverns along the high street and spread the word.
They both nodded. Charlie said, "We can't meet here. It's too small. There are about 50 gangs altogether."
"The Jolly Sailor's got a big courtyard," said Dermot, "and the landlord's not an undertaker."
"Right," Mac agreed. "Tell them to be there an hour after nightfall."
"They won't all get there," said Charlie. "Most will, though."
Dermot said,
"We'll round up as many as we can."
He and Charlie went out. Mac looked at Cora. "Are you taking an evening off?" he said hopefully. She shook her head. "Just waiting for my accomplice." It troubled Mac that Peg was a thief and Cora was responsible.
"I wish we could find a way for that child to make a living without stealing," he said.
"Why?" The question flummoxed him.
"Well, obviously."
"Obviously what?"
"It would be better if she grew up honest."
"How would it be better?" Mac heard the undertone of anger in Cora's questions, but he could not back off now.
"What she does now is dangerous. She could end up hanging at Tyburn."
"Would she be better off scrubbing the kitchen floor in some rich house, beaten by the cook and raped by the master?"
"I don't think every kitchen skivvy gets raped.
Every pretty one does. And how would I make a living without her?"
"You could do anything. You're shrewd and beautiful."
"I don't want to do anything, Mac. I want to do this."
"Why?"
"I like it. I like dressing up and drinking gin and flirting. I steal from stupid men who have more money than they deserve. It's exciting and it's easy, and I make 10 times as much as I'd get dressmaking or running a little shop or serving customers in a coffee house."
He was shocked. He had thought she would say she stole because she had to. The notion that she liked it overturned his expectations. "I really don't know you," he said.
"You're clever, Mac, but you don't know a damn thing."
Peg arrived. She was pale and thin and tired, as always. Mac said, "Have you had some breakfast?"
"No," she said, sitting down. "I'd love a glass of gin."
Mac waved at a waiter. "A bowl of porridge with cream, please."
Peg made a face, but when the food came, she tucked in with relish.
While she was eating, Caspar Gordonson came in. Mac was glad to see him. He had been thinking of calling at the Fleet Street house to discuss the shippers' boycott and the idea of a strike. Now he swiftly ran over the day's events while the untidy lawyer sipped brandy. As Mac talked, Gordonson looked more and more worried. When he had done, the lawyer began to speak in his high-pitched voice.
"You have to understand that our rulers are frightened. Not just the royal court and the government, but the entire top layer. Dukes and earls, aldermen, judges, merchants, landowners. All this talk of liberty unnerves them, and the food riots last year and the year before showed them what the people can do when they're angry."
"Good," said Mac. "Then they should give us what we want."
"Not necessarily. They're afraid that if they do that, you'll only ask for more. What they really want is an excuse to call out the troops and shoot people."
Mac could see that behind Gordonson's cool analysis there lay real fear. "Do they need an excuse?"
"Oh, yes. That's because of John Wilkes. He's a real thorn in their flesh. He accuses the government of being despotic. And as soon as troops are used against citizens, then thousands of people of the middling sort will say, 'There, Wilkes was right, and the government is a tyranny.' And all those shopkeepers and silversmiths and bakers have votes."
"So what kind of excuse does the government need?"
"They want you to scare those middling people by violence and rioting. That will get people worrying about the need to maintain order and stop them thinking about freedom of speech. Then, when the army marches in, there will be a collective sigh of relief instead of a roar of outrage."
Mac was fascinated and unnerved. He had never thought about politics this way. He had discussed high-flown theories out of books, and he had been the helpless victim of unjust laws, but this was halfway between the two. This was the zone where contending forces struggled and swayed, and tactics could alter the result. This, he felt, was the real thing, and it was dangerous. The enchantment was lost on Gordonson. He just looked worried.
"I got you into this, Mac, and if you get killed, it will be on my conscience."
His fear began to infect Mac.
4 months ago, I was just a coal miner, he thought. Now I'm an enemy of the government, someone they want to kill. Did I ask for this?
But he was under a powerful obligation. Just as Gordonson felt responsible for him, he was responsible for the coal heavers. He could not run away and hide. It would be shameful and cowardly. He had led the men into trouble, and now he had to lead them out of it.
"What do you think we should do?" he asked Gordonson.
"If the men agree to strike, your job will be to keep them under control. You'll have to stop them setting fire to ships and murdering strikebreakers and laying siege to Undertaker's taverns. These men aren't parsons, as you well know. They're young and strong and angry, and if they run riot, they'll burn London."
"I think I might be able to do that," Mac said. "They listen to me. They seem to respect me."
"They worship you," Gordonson said, "and that puts you in even greater danger. You're a ringleader, and the government may break the strike by hanging you. From the moment the men say yes, you'll be in terrible danger."
Mac was beginning to wish he had never mentioned the word strike. He said, "What should I do?"
"Leave the place where you're lodging and move somewhere else. Keep your address secret from all but a few trusted people."
Cora said, "Come and live with me." Mac managed to smile. That part would not be difficult. Gordonson went on,
"Don't show yourself on the streets in daylight, appear at meetings, then vanish. Become a ghost."
It was faintly ridiculous, Mac felt, but his fear made him accept it. "All right." Cora got up to leave. To Mac's surprise, Peg put her arms around his waist and hugged him.
"Be careful, Scotch Jock," she said. "Don't get knifed."
Mac was surprised and touched by how much they all cared for him. 3 months ago, he had never met Peg, Cora, or Gordonson. Cora kissed him on the lips and then sauntered out, already swaying her hips seductively. Peg followed. A few moments later, Mac and Gordonson left for the Jolly Sailor. It was dark, but Wapping High Street was busy, and candlelight gleamed from tavern doorways, house windows, and handheld lanterns. The tide was out, and a strong smell of rottenness wafted up from the foreshore. Mac was surprised to see the tavern's courtyard packed with men. There were about 800 coal heavers in London, and at least half of them were here. Someone had hastily erected a crude platform and placed 4 blazing torches around it for illumination. Mac pushed through the crowd. Every man recognized him and spoke a word or clapped him on the back. The news of his arrival spread quickly, and they started to cheer. By the time he reached the platform, they were roaring. He stepped up and gazed at them. Hundreds of coal-smeared faces looked back at him in the torchlight. He fought back tears of gratitude for their trust in him. He could not speak. They were shouting too loudly. He held up his hands for quiet, but it did no good. Some cried his name, others yelled, "Wilkes and Liberty!" and other slogans. Gradually, one chant emerged and came to dominate the rest, until they were all bellowing the same. "Strike! Strike! Strike!" Mac stood and stared at them, thinking, "What have I done?" Chapter 21. Joe Jamieson received a note from his father at breakfast time. It was characteristically curt. "Grosvenor Square, 8 o'clock a.m. Meet me at my place of business at noon, G.J. His first guilty thought was that father had found out about the deal he had made with Lennox. It had gone off perfectly. The shippers had boycotted the new coal-heaving gangs, as Lennox had wanted, and Lennox had returned Jay's IOUs as agreed. But now the coal-heavers were on strike, and no coal had been landed in London for a week. Had father discovered that all that might not have happened but for Jay's gambling debts? The thought was dreadful. He went to the Hyde Park encampment as usual, and got permission from Colonel Cranborough to be absent in the middle of the day. He spent the morning worrying. His bad temper made his men surly and his horses skittish. The church bells were striking 12 as he entered the Jamieson's Riverside warehouse. The dusty air was laden with spicy smells, coffee and cinnamon, rum and port, pepper and oranges. It always made Jay think of his childhood, when the barrels and tea-chests had seemed so much bigger. Now he felt as he had as a boy when he had done something naughty and was about to be carpeted. He crossed the floor, acknowledging the deferential greetings of the men, and climbed a rickety wooden staircase to the counting-house. Passing through a lobby occupied by clerks, he went into his father's office, a corner room full of maps and bills and pictures of ships. "Good morning, father," he said. "Where's Robert?" His brother was almost always at father's side. "He had to go to Rochester, but this concerns you more than him. Sir Philip Armstrong wants to see me." Armstrong was the right-hand man of Secretary of State Viscount Weymouth. Jay felt even more nervous. Was he in trouble with the government as well as with his father? What does Armstrong want? He wants this coal strike brought to an end, and he knows we started it. This did not seem to have anything to do with gambling debts, Jay inferred, but he was still anxious. He'll be here any moment now, Father added. Why is he coming here? Such an important personage would normally summon people to his office in Whitehall.
Secrecy, I imagine.
Before he could ask any more questions, the door opened and Armstrong came in. Both Jay and Sir George stood up. Armstrong was a middle-aged man, formally dressed with wig and sword. He walked with his nose a little high, as if to show that he did not usually descend into the mire of commercial activity. Sir George did not like him, Jay could tell by his father's expression as he shook hands and asked Armstrong to sit down. End of Side 10.
Side 11. Armstrong refused a glass of wine. "This strike has to end," he said. "The coal heavers have closed down half of London's industry." Sir George said, "We tried to get the sailors to uncoal the ships. It worked for a day or two. What went wrong? They were persuaded, or intimidated, or both, and now they are on strike, too." "And the watermen," Armstrong said with exasperation. "And even before the coal dispute started, there was trouble with tailors, silk weavers, hatters, sawyers. This cannot go on." "But why have you come to me, Sir Philip?" "Because I understand you were influential in starting the shippers' boycott, which provoked the coal heavers." "It's true. May I ask why?" Sir George looked at Jay, who swallowed nervously and said, "I was approached by the undertakers who organized the coal-heaving gangs. My father and I did not want the established order on the waterfront to be disturbed." "Quite right, I'm sure," Armstrong said, and Jay thought, "Get to the point. Do you know who the ringleaders are?"
"I certainly do," Jay said. "The most important is a man called Malachy McCash, known as Mac. As it happens, he used to be a coal-hewer in my father's mines."
"I'd like to see McCash arrested and charged with a capital offence under the Riot Act. But it would have to be plausible, no trumped-up charges or bribed witnesses. There would have to be a real riot, unmistakably led by striking workmen, with firearms used against officers of the Crown and numerous people killed and injured."
Jay was confused. Was Armstrong telling the Jamesons to organise such a riot? His father showed no sign of puzzlement.
"You make yourself very clear, Sir Philip." He looked at Jay. "Do you know where McCash can be found?"
"No," he said.
Then, seeing the expression of scorn on his father's face, he added hastily,
"But I'm sure I can find out."
At daybreak, Mac woke Cora and made love to her. She had come to bed in the small hours, smelling of tobacco smoke, and he had kissed her and gone back to sleep. Now he was wide awake and she was the sleepy one. Her body was warm and relaxed, her skin soft, her red hair tangled. She wrapped her arms around him loosely and moaned quietly, and at the end she gave a small cry.